Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of May. Professor David Sloan Wilson is our guest this hour. His book is Evolution for Everyone: How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. He is Distinguished Professor of Biology and Anthropology at Binghamton University, an evolutionary biologist with many interests, natural selection as a hierarchical process, the nature of interspecific variation, the evolution of ecological communities, and human evolutionary biology. He's also the author of other books, Darwin's Cathedral, Evolution, Religion, and the Nature of Society, co-author of Unto Others, The Evolution and Psychology of Unselfish Behavior. And he's also the co-editor of Evolution and the Nature of Narrative. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Professor Wilson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hey. Let's start with this theory of evolution. I love this sentence. You say, Darwin's theory by natural selection has the beauty of being both simple and profound. How so?
Absolutely. Well, it's probably the simplest great idea that ever was. The theory of relativity is hard to explain, but the theory of evolution is easy to explain, even a very short amount of time. And it's fascinating to observe that Darwin, who originated the theory, immediately began using it to think about all subjects relevant to his life. And so it's not as if you need to know a mass of detailed information. Mm. The basic concept is something which is extraordinarily powerful all by itself.
And you talk about how Darwin had all of these interests and applied this to his curiosity about the whole world. So the mail he got, I found this interesting, he'd get wagon loads of mail from people all over the world.
That's right. He's such a wonderful person to read about. And there's a beautiful two-volume biography about Darwin by Janet Brown that is just out. Mm. And I encourage everyone to read that book because it's so fascinating, not just the man, but his times. And the theory as it developed historically. So, but that's right. Darwin was such an incredible polymath, we would call him today. He was just thought about everything. And that was partially his personal attribute, but mostly, and this is the point I make in the book, is that it was the theory. And that's a good thing because we might not have Darwin's personal attributes, but we can have his theory.
Right. Tell me about this course that you teach, and it's Evolution for Everyone. You have students from all kinds of different disciplines, biology and business, cinema, computer science. Thinking about evolution, you talk about this as a course that changes their lives because it also helps them understand the world, but also helps them understand their own interests and concerns. How can evolution do that? A study of it.
Well, it's tremendously relevant, and I think one thing I say in my book is that the most discouraging fact about acceptance of evolution is not that 50% don't believe the theory at all, but that nearly 100% don't connect it to anything important in their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the sculpting action of evolution is shaping the properties of all creatures. So obviously it's needed to understand the living world, but it's also shaped the property of us. Our species, and not just our biological nature, but also cultural diversity and the way we even our thoughts. And so when you take evolutionary theory seriously and we break down the barrier, for most of the 20th century, evolution was confined to the biological sciences and excluded from all human-related subjects. But all of that is changing now. And that's what I communicate in my class and attempt to do in my book.
Yeah. Before we go away from this, let's talk about why it is that the general public has a hard time accepting the theory of evolution. You quote here, and I just find this astounding, a Harris poll with 54% of adults in this country believing that humans did not develop from earlier species, and that number has gone up.
Right. But I don't think that's inevitable, and I think that this is a little bit like polls, you know, in 1 week everyone could be against a candidate, and the next week everyone can be for them. So I'm actually not so concerned about those numbers, because the problem is, once again, if evolution doesn't mean anything to you in any real-world sense, then you can afford to ignore it. But as soon as you start, as soon as you start to put it to use as an explanatory principle and a way to make your life better and everyone's life better, then there's a reason to accept it. And at that point, then creationism and intelligent design just falls away, because those are non-explanatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so there actually is a solution to this problem, as strange as it might seem and as recalcitrant as it might seem. Most people who take my course, and I think most people who read my book, are actually not going to be tempted by alternative devolution. They'll find it easy to accept.
Tell me, there's so many interesting studies in the book, and let me just pick one. The one that you did with, I believe they were high school age students, and you were looking at who's most likely to be altruistic, who to take on making the world a better place, et cetera.
Right.
What does that have to – tell me about the study, and tell me what it has to do with evolution.
Well, I mean, the reason that evolution has been so hard for so many people to accept, among others, is that it seems to explain selfishness more easily than altruism.
Mm.
And that's threatening for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that the theory can explain altruism. It offers a very good explanation of altruism, which is also very simple. Namely, that if you're an altruist, you'll do just fine as long as you're associating with other altruists. Altruism succeeds to the extent that altruists can get together and avoid associating with non-altruists. And in a nutshell, obviously it can become much more complicated, but in a nutshell, that is the secret for the success of all things that we associate with goodness. And what the study showed was that teenagers, American teenagers, going about their everyday lives, the ones that were most other-oriented, pro-social, actually were doing very well as individuals, precisely because they were in nurturing social environments. And you could actually find some that weren't. They were like fish out of water. They were nice as individuals, but they were in nasty social environments. And they were exceptionally stressed. So it's not as if this is a behavior that works under all conditions for everyone. It requires special conditions. But since we know what those are, then that's where you can begin to use the theory, basically, in a pragmatic sense to improve the quality of life. And incidentally, at this moment, I am sitting in the Binghamton City School District, where I've been meeting with some of the school superintendent and other people to put these ideas to use in a very meaningful way in our schools and communities.
Oh, that's great. That's something that's needed all over the country, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. And then that just goes to show you that once you start talking in these terms, no one cares that you're using the E word. They just want to make things better. And if evolution can help you do that, then so much the better for evolution.
And what got you interested in this whole area and exploring the area scientifically, altruism? Isn't that far from Darwin or not?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, altruism is one of the most famous puzzles of evolution, precisely because, superficially, when you begin thinking about it, altruism does seem to be maladaptive. If evolution's about surviving and reproducing better than anyone else, then that should select for selfishness, because altruists are causing others to survive and reproduce at their own expense. So that's the initial puzzle.
Right.
And when I entered graduate school, that puzzle was very much at the forefront of what people were thinking about. And I was attracted to it because it would seem to be, I was an ambitious young man and I wanted to make a name for myself. And this would certainly be, to show how altruism could evolve, would be a great contribution, thought I.
Yeah.
And at that time it was not with respect to humans. One of the interesting things, we think these ideas are just, concerned with religion and humans. But this tension between selfishness and altruism, groups functioning as adaptive units as opposed to individuals, this pervades the biological world.
Right. Yeah.
All social species are confronted with this problem.
Yeah.
And so what we associate with morality is actually a dilemma, a problem with partial solutions, which is found throughout nature, all the way down to bacteria and even the origin of life itself, as I recount briefly in my book.
Yeah, interesting. And so some of the and do we get it from our evolution from apes, from chimps and bonobos, et cetera? How have they manifested altruism? How do they take care of the group? How do they take care of each other? And is that something that has evolved more highly in humans?
Well, yes, and it's important to go beyond altruism. When we think of altruism, we think of sort of, you know, Barney the dinosaur and Mr. Rogers, which is one kind of altruism. I'm not disparaging it, but there's many other mechanisms that enable groups to function adaptively, and some of those are just plain nice, and others of those are more ambiguous. They involve social control, sometimes often coercive social control, mm-hmm. social norms in their establishment, and so on and so forth. So one way that bonobos cooperate, especially females, is through sexuality as a kind of a social currency. Bonobos are the first feminists. The females gang together. Basically, they form alliances, and they cement those alliances with sex, and that enables them to resist male domination.
Huh.
So that's a good example of how a particular group can function as a group, and yet it doesn't really look like. I mean, it's more complicated and more interesting than just plain old cooperation.
The Vikings of Iceland, you point out, among the fiercest people on Earth. Now they're the most peaceful. In principle, it's possible to completely eliminate violent conflict by eliminating its preferred habitat. What does that mean?
Well, it means that this is what's so interesting, important, and simple about looking at human diversity from this ecological and evolutionary perspective. When we're, as biologists, if you're a biologist, as I am, you go out there and you see thousands of species, many species. Why are they all there? Why are they coexisting? Well, they're all surviving and reproducing in different ways. And crudely speaking, they occupy different niches. And so if you now go to humans and you see humans behaving in different ways, sometimes very violent, sometimes peaceable, think of the vast diversity, cultural diversity, and within each culture, the diversity of individuals. And then just start to think, maybe this diversity can be explained in the same way. And every enduring kind of behavior has its niche in which it thrives, and therefore other niches in which it doesn't thrive. Hmm. And so there's nothing categorical you can say about the way we behave. We're not fated to be violent. We're fated to be violent in certain situations and amply prepared. So I'm not saying that we're a peaceful species or anything like it. We're definitely genetically and culturally prepared to be violent, but only under some circumstances. And so change the niche, change the environment, and you can change the behavior. That's why it's so important to be a sophisticated evolutionist if you want to change our lives.
Mm-hmm. And put that in the context of the Vikings. They eliminated what preferred habitat?
Well, there was a time in which they could, from their home base, they could go and they could raid and plunder, and all of that was between group conflict. Within groups, they were much more peaceable and well organized. They weren't just killing each other in the same way that they were plundering others. But then there came a time in which they were unable to make a living in that way, and they became a more agrarian and peaceful society within themselves, to make a long story short.
Mm-hmm. I know that you are an avid observer of all kinds of life. Are there certain species that you just find dumbfounding because of their extremely interesting behavior, Professor Wilson?
Well, they're all fascinating, and one of the great discoveries over the last few decades is how sophisticated many species are. Many of us, if we're not trained as biologists, and even those who were when I was in grad school, had this sort of assumption that animals are simpler than us in some sense. We have this exalted view of our own intelligence, especially,
mm-hmm.
Which made us think that all other creatures are unsophisticated. But sort of robot-like, you know. But come to study them, and we see that every species, even the so-called simplest, can be amazingly sophisticated in their strategies that enable them to survive and reproduce in their environment. And for me, if I was to single one out, it would be the social insects, because those are true superorganisms. The colony is the organism. The individuals have become organ-like, and part of that is that the colony has a mind which is not contained in any single individual. And the idea of a group mind is mind-boggling in any sense.
Right, right.
It's been documented beautifully for social insects, and it has tremendous applicability to human mentality, something that we've only begun to think about.
Yeah, and what are some of the social insects?
Well, the ants, the bees, the termites. These are the insects which live in highly organized colonies with a queen that does the reproducing, and non-reproductive workers.
Can we talk for a moment about dogs?
Oh, of course. Are you a dog fancier?
Yeah, I think I'm going to raise dogs when I retire.
Uh-huh.
I more and more, the older I get, the more I like dogs. I'm not sure what that means, but I really like dogs, yeah. They're smart, huh?
Well, they're smart. They're very smart in some respects, and this actually continues the theme. You know, we think that humans are the most intelligent creatures on Earth, and then apes must come next because they're our closest relatives,
right.
And then dogs would be somewhere down the line. But it turns out that there's no single trait called intelligence. There's many ways to be smart or dumb. And so when it comes to functioning as team players, basically, in a group, humans are vastly smarter than our closest ape relatives. So they cooperate to a degree, but they're not as ultra cooperative. That's what sets us apart as a species, is we're the primate equivalent of a beehive. And these are very new ideas that have only come to the fore within the last 10 or 20 years. And so things that come naturally to us, such as pointing, apes just don't get it. There's things that babies do, and human babies do, in terms of shared cognition, knowing the intentions of adults, which apes don't get at any age, and dogs do.
Huh.
And why do dogs get it? It's because they joined human society about, the estimate is 130,000 years ago, and so they have been genetically co-evolving with us.
Huh.
And so in these cooperative team player respects, dogs are smarter than apes and wolves, even wolves raised in captivity. So this is some of the fascinating nuances that you get when you start thinking seriously about evolution.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. We'll take them in just one moment. The number is 800-486-8655. David Sloan Wilson is our guest. The book is Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. He is a distinguished professor of biology and anthropology at Binghamton University and is the author also of Darwin's Cathedral, Evolution, Religion, and the Nature of Society, and co-author of Unto Others, The Evolution and Psychology of Unselfish Behavior. Our lines are filled. Just keep the number in mind, and we'll get to you as soon as we can. 800-486-8655-227-2050 in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655-227-2050. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, let's start with Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I wanted the professor's opinion on a book that I read some time back. I thought it was a good book, and his comment is important to me because it's not one of his books, and it's Bruce Bagamile's Biological Exuberance, Animal Homosexuality, and Natural Diversity. And the reason I bring it up is when I read it, I thought that it was touching on a topic that evolutionists sort of rejected. And, of course, religionists find no use for any justification for homosexuality in the animal world. They generally have declared it a la Laura Schlesinger, the physiologist or gym teacher talk show host, as sort of a natural error. And according to Bagamile, at least, if it's not very common, it's at least naturally occurring and common and doesn't occur merely under stressful situations. And so I'll stop there and listen on the radio.
All right, thanks for the call.
Yeah, Rich, that's a great question. And it turns out I just gave a talk on based on that book and some more books.
Oh, my gosh.
On homosexuality to a very interesting group of science advisors to the mainstream Protestant religion. So this is a very hot topic. And there's a tendency, always has been a tendency, if you want to prohibit a behavior, what do you call it? You call it unnatural, you call it sick, you call it immature. And these are not good actual explanations of the behavior. So biological exuberance is a compendium of examples of homosexual behavior in the animal world. And there is a great deal of scholarship on homosexual behavior in human cultures around the world. And so to keep this short, as soon as you start thinking of sexuality as more than just reproduction, but also a form of social currency, then homosexuality ceases to be an enigma. And so I just gave the examples of the bonobos in which females use they're pansexual. They use sex as a currency for all kinds of relationships, including things that would strike us as completely perverse, such as mother-offspring relationships. You know, can you imagine mothers sexually fondling their very young infants?
No.
But that's what they do, and it's not unnatural. So, but it gets especially fascinating when you start to look at human cultures, and especially Roman pagan culture, which forms the backdrop for Christian attitudes about homosexuality. And there you discover, not only then but now in many cultures today, including prison cultures and many other cultures, is that sex is not about gender, it's about power. And powerful males will penetrate anyone that's under their power, men and women.
Hmm.
And so the varieties of homosexuality that have existed cross-culturally, including the current form, is just fascinating to study, and it just really, this kind of scholarship completely eliminates the notion that homosexuality is in some simple way unnatural.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dave next from Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I just had three questions. My first question is when did the origin of life begin? Who or what started the origin of life? And if you can't give me specific answers on that, aren't you really just putting your faith into a theory which is just that, a theory?
Okay, Dave, those are three good questions. And I don't want to say that scientists have figured out the origin of life, but also science is always about discovering new things. And so it's not... no blame on science if there's things that we don't know about. But the origin of life, here's the speculation about the origin of life, which I find fascinating and describe briefly in my book. It traces back to this idea of altruism and selfishness and groups functioning as organisms, basically, and the problems of that with respect to disruption by conflict from within. And to make a long story short, it's possible that what life is and the origin of life were groups of cooperating molecular reactions.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, a naked RNA strand, that's an individual RNA strand, just doesn't do it. It needs to have helpers, basically, in order to replicate with fidelity.
Huh.
And so the best theory we have for the origin of life is tiny fellowships of cooperating molecular reactions. And I think that's aesthetically pleasing, if nothing else. And so scientists are working on it. It's one of the great mysteries, of course, because it lies so much in the distant past. But I don't think it's beyond the reach of scientific of explanation myself.
Mm-hmm. Richard from Oshkosh. Oh, Richard, hello? Sorry, Richard, you got a real bad phone connection. If you could call us back, that would be great. Roland is next from Eau Claire. Hello?
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I'd like to address the problem with religion. I was once a pre-seminary student, but after I read Darwin's Origin of Species and so forth, I realized that there is no place in modern thinking for religion, because natural selection vanquished intelligent design. There is no divine agency in operating in the world, and therefore there is no divine agency at all. And I had asked myself some questions. Where did God become interested in man? When we were Homo ergaster, Homo habilis, Australopithecines. And I think there is another evolutionary factor at work here. The church is powerful. It has powerful people in it. Evolution favors powerful leadership. And the public rejects Darwin because they have to reject this simple idea that if there is no fall of man, then there is no need for a redeemer. And the whole edifice of religion collapses. So I think evolution opposes religion very vehemently. And I think we always have to stand up for what is true. And unfortunately, science is true.
Yeah, I think you may have a different point of view on this, Professor Wilson. Go ahead.
Well, not entirely, and I wish we had a long time. Really good questions require long answers, and we don't have time for long answers here. But I think that I am, along with Roland, an atheist in my personal convictions. So
are
some of my colleagues, such as Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins, who have both written very high-profile books on evolution. I think that religions, I personally think that religions are 100% a social construction.
Mm.
That does not make them uninteresting or unimportant. Many other people have other solutions to this problem, including solutions such as, God is present but set the universe in motion, the laws of evolution, and so on and so forth.
Right.
I think that, again, just to pick and choose a few interesting points here, I study religion a lot. I spend a lot of my time not just studying religion but interacting with religious believers. And when you think of religions as systems of belief and practice that organize communities, okay? And Durkheim said this a long ago. In many ways, we're just reviving Durkheim's ideas. That dignifies religion in many ways. So, I mean, that's a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's possible to study religion from a purely evolutionary perspective in a way which, as strange as it might seem, affirms many religious values, not just communitarian values, but the idea that transformation is possible, that individuals and societies can be much better in the future than in the past. That's an important part of the religious imagination. And what would that be but cultural evolution?
Mm-hmm.
So transmitting our best values to our children. So in many ways, I have a greater affinity for committed religious believers than I do for some, at least, atheists. There's many flavors of atheists, many flavors of religious believers. But I think that there's something very wise and worth studying and respecting about religions, even though I certainly agree with Roland that we live in a purely naturalistic world, and that religions, as good as they are, and of course they also have a dark side, are 100% social constructions, but they can still be beautiful for all that.
Interesting. How do you answer the question of purpose?
Well, purpose, large and small, natural selection endows all creatures with a very strong sense of purpose for surviving and reproducing, and there is various scales at which that can happen. It can be just you and your offspring, or it can be your whole society. It can even be all of humanity. So that form of purpose is easy to explain. A wider sense of purpose, some sort of cosmic purpose or long-term purpose to evolution, is more difficult to explain and might not even exist.
Hmm. You've said, before we get off this topic, in the book, you do speaking about evolution, morality, and religion to audiences all over the world. Your most memorable, and I'm wondering why you pointed to this one, a televised conversation with a group of faculty and monks from St. John's University in Minnesota, Catholic University, and the oldest Benedictine monastery in the nation. Why did that stick in your mind?
Well, because you'd think that the more I talked, I mean, that the more religious a person gets, the more difficulty they'd have with my ideas, right?
Right.
And it turns out not to be the case. So when I speak with really committed people, and a Benedictine monk has dedicated his life to his religion,
mm-hmm.
to find common ground is extraordinary and wonderful. And incidentally, at the St. John's University. They have a wonderful church. It was built, I think, in the 1930s and was very avant-garde for its time. And you go into this church, and the whole, one whole huge wall is a beautiful stained glass window, and which in a honeycomb motif. So what you see is a gorgeous, you know, the inspirational quality of a stained glass window, very starkly with against a honeycomb background. And religious believers throughout history have compared their communities to single bodies, the organism of Christ. We see the same thing among the bees gathering honey. And here was this displayed artistically right there. Huh. And that's what we're saying is that this is not a poetic metaphor. This can be taken literally, that religious groups are organisms in the same way that single bodies and social insect colonies are organisms, and the same theory can explain all of them.
Hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to Bob from Darlington. Hello, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, thanks for letting me talk to the professor.
Sure.
You know, of all of the species on Earth, why do we humans seem to be the most arrogant?
well, actually, I think there's individual differences. There's some arrogant members of our species, but there's some members of our species that are very humble. And so what we should really be studying is again, I went back to when we see individual differences, how can we explain them? You know, they both have their niches. There are situations that favor arrogance and other situations that favor humility. But humility, and this brings us back to religion and why it's possible to study religion in a very positive way, even as a social construction. Humility is not exclusively a religious virtue, but it's one religious virtue. And I think that if you study how religious groups work, you realize that humility is working very importantly in order to prevent domination and exploitation in all its forms. If you're going to exploit someone, then that's a form of arrogance. And if you have humility, then you're not going to exploit someone. You're going to operate as a team player, basically. You're going to, not going to raise yourself above others. And so here we have, I think, an excellent question and an excellent example of how these ideas, which are so important and so familiar to us, can actually be translated into the language of evolution. And then you can make interesting statements about them as to why these things exist and how we can change them, basically, and to cultivate humility, something which religious people attempt to do and that we would do well to attempt also.
Right.
Anything else, Bob?
I was just wondering if the professor had any idea what's killing off our wonderful honeybees.
I don't. I'm no expert on that, but of course it's a terrible problem and concern, and it's one of many examples of humans having powerful effects on the whole planet now. Mm-hmm. And so there's another example in which we have to have humility about our technological prowess and to use it responsibly.
It seems quite strange, doesn't it?
Absolutely strange. And evidently something's happening that causes these animals to disorient.
Yeah.
We don't know if it's a disease or if it's a pesticide or something which has a sublethal effect. And so it's not the only example of human-induced changes that we have to study very hard.
Right. Thank you for the answers. They seem to be really great.
Sure. Thanks
Thank
a lot.
You. Thanks for the call. Let's go back to that class you teach. And you talk in the book about students increasing their general thinking skills as a result of studying evolution, not just their knowledge about evolution. In other words, they got smarter.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, that's what happens when you have, if you don't have a theory, then you have many disparate facts that are not hanging together. It's like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that haven't been put together. If you do have a theory, then all these pieces fit together, and you can use the same principles, the same framework, basically, for studying subjects which previously seemed totally disparate from each other. And that, so this begins with Darwin. There he was. And then he gets this theory, and all of a sudden he's studying barnacles and orchids and people and morality and emotions and his children, and there's nothing he can look at without applying these principles. And so that's what anybody can do, as strange as that might seem. And I teach an exercise very early in my class in which I have the students make predictions about infanticide, that's a particular behavior, and when it might exist, the circumstances under which it might exist. And basically, an ounce of evolutionary thinking enables them to make very smart predictions about something that they've probably never thought about very much before, haven't read anything about. That's the sense in which if you know something about the organism, something about the environment, you can make very good guesses about the properties of the organism. And that's a form of intelligence. That's why I, on the professional level, and again, I'm not boasting about myself, I and my colleagues can just switch subjects. Well, how is it possible for me to write a book on religion or literature or Beatles or...
Right.
That's, I mean, what gives me that kind of intelligence? Well, it's not anything to do with me. It's the theory that I've learned, and that's what I can pass on.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Bob, for the call. Mary is next from Kenosha. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Boy. I thank you for having him on. I love hearing a lot of his ideas. I don't know if I agree with them. One of the ideas I had is, well, I'm a gardener, and I love bees and I love ants. Termites I haven't had any experience with. But it seems to me that they are sort of a smaller kind of thing than we are, but we don't get it. And when we were to be on this planet, in this universe, to learn to cooperate, to fit together, to make the whole thing work, and we get into war with each other because we don't realize that we all have needs that are somewhat the same, and people get selfish and take too much to themselves, things like that. So that was one of my thoughts. And also this thing about religions, I'm in a time in my life when I'm transforming from one thing to another. I've been part of several different kinds of churches, and I read a lot from a lot of different kinds of religions, and I respect them all, and I love them all, and I still don't know how I fit in. But it seems to me that there really is some prime consciousness beyond us somehow, because of some of the experiences I've had. I mean, I've had an experience where I saw my mother as soon as she died, and I was hundreds of miles away, and the angel was with her, so I knew she was dead. And I could list a whole kinds of experience. So I know that there's some kind of spirit that's bigger than us that guides us and wants us to be loving and giving to others.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on and on for an hour, but I'll stop
right.
See if he has any response to it.
All right. Thanks, Mary.
Well, Mary, another set of good questions that require long answers, so I'm just going to touch on a couple of points. But when it comes to cooperation, we have to think about the scale at which cooperation occurs. So those ants and bees and so on, they're cooperating so well within their colonies. But as colonies, they're fighting other colonies. So ants are famous for their species of ants that have evolved to be slave-making ants. So slavery, believe it or not, exists in ants. So cooperation exists within the colony, but then there's all sorts of mayhem that exists between colonies. And humans are just like that. We're special as a species because we're ultra-cooperative at the level of a single tribe or a single group. But then we do towards other groups what all creatures do, and so that's where the mayhem exists. So the problem there is to cultivate amicable relationships among groups and also to expand the size of the groups, the moral circle, so to speak, and so ultimately get rid of conflict that way. And that is possible. And in fact, you know, I mean, 13,000 years ago, before the advent of agriculture, nobody back then could have ever guessed or even imagined groups of many, many millions of individuals that were roughly cooperating with each other. That's actually extraordinary that we would have that capacity as a species to do something which had never existed in our ancestral past at all. And we can thank our cultural flexibility for that. So I think that it's actually possible to expand the moral circle still wider, but not without guidance. We have to really be smart. That's another reason to be a sophisticated evolutionist. Unless you know about evolutionary processes, you won't know how to accomplish that. Now, with respect to religion and the powerful feeling of these spiritual forces out there. I appreciate what you're saying, and I know I've not experienced this myself, but I've talked to many people who have so compellingly that they must believe it. But I think that we really have to take seriously the fact that several hundred years ago, everyone thought that God's presence was so great in this world that by understanding his creation, the physical forces of the world, the orbits of the planets, and certainly the creatures that he made, that we would be able to discern God's intentions and God's handiwork, basically, through his creation. And all of those ideas failed the scientific test. Ultimately, they were rejected again and again and again.
Okay, I need to just interrupt for a moment, and we have to pause for a second.
Okay.
And we'll be welcoming more phone calls momentarily. Our guest is the author of Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. David Sloan Wilson is our guest, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming phone calls for David. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And his book is Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. Mary, thank you very much for the call. And we go to Boyd next from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Professor Wilson. This is a really great show. I just want to say a number of things, and I've got a couple questions. I did want to respond to a previous caller when he kind of, I couldn't help but cringe a little when he kind of just referred to evolution as a theory. In The Origin of the Species, as you know, Darwin had said that life came from a common ancestor, but to find proof of that common ancestor, it would probably even predate the fossil record. But as you know, looking through transitional fossils, those are good ways to back up his theory. I think when he just mentioned also, you know, like I said, evolution being a theory, well, you could say the same thing about gravity as well, but we pretty much come to the conclusion gravity is all around us. I know you were mentioning also Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett. I guess I just want to get two questions I have. I know Dawkins kind of believes more in a gradual phase, if I'm not mistaken, of evolution, where someone like Stephen Jay Gould believed in spontaneous equilibrium. I wanted to get your take if both of their theories had some substance, if one, in your view, is more superior than the other. And then my other question is, have you ever read anything on Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus? Because I find him a very fascinating individual, and I would love to read more on him. And that's pretty much it.
All right.
Take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Boyd.
Okay, so very quickly, three great questions. I think that all this business about theory, I'm fine with the fact that evolution's a theory, as long as we understand what a theory is. And as part of the humility that we need as scientists, not to be arrogant. It would be arrogant for a scientist to say we know this and so on and so forth. There's tons and tons of stuff that we don't know, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. But there's still a sense in which scientific progress occurs, and that's the sense in which creationism and certainly intelligent design, once you look into it even a little bit, the whole problem with this is that these ideas are presented to people who don't have time or don't have the background to really scrutinize them as anyone would, and so they survive on that basis. So evolution's a theory, but once we understand that, then we can be quite certain about it in the same way that we're certain about gravity. With respect to Dawkins versus Gould, that's such. I'm just going to pass on that. There's merits to both of those. They're both great evolutionists that are emphasize different themes I just can't give that a short answer, but it's a great question, and punctuated equilibrium and continuous evolution. This is the sort of things I think, you know, people should be widely reading about. So many more people, if they were to become interested in evolution in a positive sense, as many people are, then these things would be discussed rather than this sterile debate about creationism and intelligent design. And finally, Erasmus. I already mentioned Janet Brown's biography, which says quite a bit about the background. And what really distinguished Darwin from his predecessors, including his own grandfather, is that he supplied the specific mechanism. Other people had speculated about evolution, but not in the kind of rigor and scientific detail that he did. And one reason that Darwin spent so much time studying barnacles, for example, is that he was working so hard to establish his credentials as a great scientist. His reputation was fabulous even before the theory of evolution. So that's what distinguished Darwin from previous speculators about evolution, was that Darwin provided the actual mechanism, plus, of course, a whole bunch of data.
Mm. And his reputation was fabulous before evolution because why?
Well, I mean, he started out coming back from the voyage of the Beagle. He was mostly a geologist, and he had provided lots of evidence for Lyell's theory of geology, which was a theory of continuous change.
Mm-hmm.
And then only later did he begin to think about the species question as a sort of an extension of his thoughts about all things, not just the Earth, the features of the Earth, but also life itself being a product of forces that are taking place all around us.
Mm.
And so he was almost a celebrity as a naturalist, mm-hmm. and as a distinguished scientist before he launched his theory of evolution.
We go next to Laura from New Berlin. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you. If one holds the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, as the highest ideal, and considers that humans, by virtue of a look back at history, have violated that oath so egregiously, so colossally, one might assert that humans are indeed the lowest life form, indeed a failed species, considering their vast despoliation of the planet, their calculated warfare, even their sadistic behavior a la torture. Just wondering how the guests would respond, and thank you for the program.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thanks, Laura. I don't think we should be too hard on our species. I think our main problem is that we've become so numerous and so world-dominating that when we do what all species do, it now has planetary effects. And so, you know, there's a myth that indigenous people, tribal people, had this great respect for the Earth and, you know, seven generations and things like that. Often that's not the case, and they're as willing to exploit the Earth as much as anyone else, but they're just doing it at a small enough scale so that they could, for example, slash and burn and, you know, tear down the forest, and then when they deplete their local resources, they can just move over to the next valley, and then the their old site can regenerate. So that's our problem, and we're behaving like all species behave, and we have these disastrous planetary consequences. And so now we need to do something which has never happened before. We need to cooperate at a huge social scale, but more or less planetary, and not just for our short-term gain, but for our long-term gain, seven generations. That has got to be one of the most difficult challenges ever faced by any species. And so rather than sort of castigating ourselves, I think we just need to rise to the occasion, basically, and to use our scientific knowledge as best we can. And that will definitely include knowledge about evolution. One of the amazing facts is because evolution has been confined to biology and has not been applied to human-related subjects, that economists, political scientists, politicians of all stripes, sociologists, anthropologists have not availed themselves of knowledge of evolution. And so that's one reason why I'm passionate about the fact that everyone needs to learn about evolution in this positive sense in order to solve these very, very grave problems.
Ed is next from Baraboo. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, hi. Dr. Sloan, I just had two short questions here, which may require long answers.
No, they can't because we only have 40 seconds left. Sorry.
the questions, where do you come down on the side of the question of free will? And do honeybees and ants behave morally?
Okay.
Ah, okay. And now I have just 20 seconds.
Sorry. Right? Yes, sorry.
Well, free will is a great evolutionary topic. In fact, all deep philosophical questions need to be approached from an evolutionary perspective. And morality is fundamentally about other and group-oriented behaviors, and that exists throughout the world, throughout the biological world. We have a particular form of morality, and for us it's important how we think about it. But morality is something which is just deeply, deeply embedded in this problem about groups that it has come up again and again in this conversation and is a major theme in my book.
Yeah, it sure is. Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great hour. Thanks.
Sure.
Our guest, David Sloan Wilson. The book is Evolution for Everyone, How Darwin's Theory Can Change the Way We Think About Our Lives. It has just been published by Delacorte Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production. And thanks for all of your very intelligent calls. They were good. This show repeats at 10 o'clock tonight in case you want to tell somebody to be sure and tune it in. And we'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 until 11. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News ahead. It's a minute before 11. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.